Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
When a mantra is sung, the vibration can be felt and it changes the way you feel. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and on ABC Radio National Summer, this is The Spirit of Things, where mantras are going mainstream, with my guests today, Deva Premel and Miten. The voice of Deva Premel, singing the mantras she began to learn as a child. Mantras are sacred chants, usually in Sanskrit, which originated in the Vedic tradition of meditation and developed in Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and the Sikh tradition. The words and the sounds of the mantras encapsulate large notions, like the union of male and female principles, or the divine manifestations of the one God. They're meant to be beautiful and hypnotic, something Deva Premel seems to achieve effortlessly. Deva is part of a duo, on stage and off, with Miten. Their story speaks of a generation who turned east. They were the Orange People, followers of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, the controversial guru who was briefly imprisoned, then expelled from the US in 1985, when his community called Rajneesh Purnam in Oregon collapsed amid a host of criminal allegations. Bhagwan, often called the Laughing Guru because he loved telling jokes, returned to his original ashram in Pune, India, and gave himself a new name, Osho. He died in 1990. I was curious to meet Deva Premel and Miten, who still believe in Osho. Deva Premel and Miten, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I saw your performance in Sydney, and it was a really beautiful experience. I think when you came out onto the stage, the atmosphere seemed to fill with the fragrance of flowers, the scent of flowers, which was quite wonderful. But the audience roared, and I got a sense that you have a real following.
I think the mantras have a following. You know, the music we sing, they really, if I can go by the messages we received, they've really helped people. And people have really had deep experiences with the music. So somehow it feels like a family, you know. It feels like we've been together, we've been singing together already for many years or weeks or months. Well, and finally we come together.
They certainly knew a lot of the mantras. At first I thought that they were very quick to learn the chants, but many people in the audience already knew them and joined in.
Yeah, they've integrated these mantras into their lives, you know. You know, we get emails about people using them for childbirth and to help them through depression and all kinds of amazing moments in people's lives, auspicious moments, you know. And when that happens with a piece of music, of course, you know, it's in your heart. So, you know, when you come to meet the people who put that CD out, there's already a connection of love happening. So that fragrance of flowers that you experienced was love. It was actually love.
You started with Hare Govinda, I think.
Yeah. It was Radhe Govinda and Radha, and Govinda is another name for Krishna. So it was just the name of Radha and Krishna, the divine couple, and that's the symbol of divine union, of the merging of the female and male principle and respect. And also, you know, Radha is so devoted to Krishna. It's also a symbol of our love to the divine. It's like it's that devotion from the Radha to Krishna is actually our devotion to the divine. But it's kind of put into a form that we can relate to it because it's also a couple, you know. And we all know what it feels like to be just madly in love. And it's...
Well, you certainly radiate that on stage. Miten, you often look over at Deva Pramal with a very devoted look on your face.
Oh, I do? Uh-huh.
You do. Deva, your name is actually means...
It's a Sanskrit name, and it means divine loving.
Yes.
I haven't chosen it. It was given to me, so I'm still working on it.
Who gave it to you?
My spiritual master, Osho. He was Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh at the time. That was in 81 that I received that name, when I was 11 years old.
Tell me about your involvement with Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh. Was that in Oregon?
He was still in India at the time, but soon after that he left to Oregon. Yeah, I grew up with Eastern spirituality through my father, who was very deeply into yoga and Zen and wanted to pass it on to his daughters, his families. He really felt that was a precious thing he had found, and he used the mantras as part of our daily lives. One mantra, the Gayatri, was for just before sleeping. And then there were Zen stories before eating, which we all knew by heart and would recite. And so all this Eastern path was very familiar to me. Also reincarnation, you know, was just, although I grew up in Germany, but reincarnation was like, of course, that's what it is like, you know. And then when I came across Osho, I just love the meditations. He's created some active meditations, which I love to do as a 10, 11-year-old.
Active meditation, is that dancing?
Dancing, you know, shaking, breathing, also catharsis, you know, letting out the stuff which you keep in. So they are made for the Western people, you know, who are not able to immediately maybe sit for an hour without moving, you know, who first need to let go of stuff, you know.
Well, Osho, or Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh, was certainly very fond of active meditation. I think he was a bit suspicious of the ability of Westerners to just sit quietly.
I think he knew that he could help them, you know, there was not only active meditations, you know, he also created silent ones. But he felt like if you did those, there was two meditations, Kundalini and dynamic meditations. If you did them, you would really have a different experience of the day if you cleaned out, you know, once a day. And then you can enter that silence so much more easily. And that's what we need in this life, you know, bombarded by everything and the speed we are living in and everything.
Well, Miten, when did you come across Osho? Because I think your background is somewhat different.
Very different.
You came through the rock band scene, didn't you?
I came, my parents were actually, they were pub owners. So my early memories of my mother is singing in pubs, you know, playing the piano and as a little kid.
What part of England?
At that time, it was in the kind of Midlands. We lived in places near Northamptonshire and Bedfordshire, around there, kind of North London. And I think through my mother, I just picked up music, you know, and moved, as we all did, into the tidal wave of Beatlemania and that whole amazing movement that happened back then. And, you know, my peers began to look deeper into life than we had in the past, I guess, you know. And, well, that's what happened for me. Rock and roll music stopped nourishing me at some point, and I knew there was something more. I just didn't know what.
But you were playing with or opening the Kinks and, you know, very well-known bands.
Yeah.
Lou Reed.
Yeah. Fleetwood Mac was the big one for that Rumours tour. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it just didn't fit the bill, you know. I was at an age where it just looked pointless. But the music spoke of something beyond what I knew. And... actually, what happened for me was I read a book by Bhagwan, and there was a story in there. It was a Zen story, actually. And the story was related to a Zen nun who was carrying, Chiono, her name was, and she was carrying water from the well at night time, and she happened to be looking in the water in the bucket, and the reflection of the moon that was there in the bucket, and suddenly the bucket broke, and in that moment she realized, she became enlightened, and she realized that she'd spent her whole life looking at the reflection of the real thing, and she turned around and saw the real thing. And in a way, that was how it was for me with music. Like, I was singing and I knew there was something there because the reflection was so strong, but it wasn't until I learned meditation and learned to look inside that the real thing appeared, you know.
So how did you find your way to the ashram? I mean, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was certainly pretty controversial at that time.
Well, yeah, I like controversy. He lived on the edge. He didn't really care so much what people thought. And what looked like a probably pretty weird situation from the outside was for me and the people inside was an incredible experiment, especially with sexuality, because, you know, known as the sex guru, and actually, in fact, ironically, he was helping us to transcend the excitement of sexuality and come to terms with actually what sexuality is and what tantra is. So he was helping us to breathe and helping us to respect and look at each other, learn from each other as man and woman. So it was an incredible experiment and dangerous because, of course, it looked something totally different on the outside. But happily and fortunately for me, I was lucky to be inside.
So when did you go to Pune?
Almost about the same age. Not the same age as David, but the same time, late 70s, early 80s.
But Deva Pramal was 11 and you would have been somewhat older.
I was a lot older. We didn't meet until Deva was 20. I was already 42.
Right.
23. We have 23 years different in age, and when I first hugged Deva, I realized she was actually older soul than me. There's no doubt, you know.
And what did you think, Deva?
I didn't really think that much. I just felt good. You know?
Miten, what does your name mean?
Miten means friend. Osho gave me the name Prabhu Miten. Prabhu is like my sweet lord. Or it's like it's the way you would address God very sweetly, Prabhu. It's the... And so he gave me the name Prabhu Miten, friend of God, or be a friend to yourself, which at the time was incredibly poignant because I'd left my whole world behind, my family, my record company, publisher, music associates, everybody. I just disappeared out of everybody's life and didn't have a friend in the world. And he, without him knowing that, he gave me the name Friend of God. I knew I was in the right place. Moonlight streaming through this temple door. I'm seeing myself like I never did before. Seeing myself through the eyes of an angel, through the eyes of an angel.
Miten of Deva Pramal and Miten singing his composition Through the Eyes of an Angel from their album Soul in Wonder. And they're my guests on The Spirit of Things. Rock music owes a lot to the spiritual search of its musicians. As an Eastern quest, it started when the Beatles went from being cuddly Liverpudlians to exotic avatars with guitars. Their guru was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who died at the age of 91. The Beatles drifted away from the Maharishi, but my guests today, Deva Pramal and Miten, remain true to their guru, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, or Osho, who died in India at the age of 59, after a very colourful life. And it was around that time when they met.
Through the eyes of the Blessed One, through the eyes of an angel, here I stand, naked in the morning sun, blessing the earth I stand upon.
Well, that was 1990, I think.
When we met, yeah.
Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh had just died or was about to die.
Yeah, he left in January 19th, 1990. Yeah.
So what was happening then at the ashram? It must have been quite a turbulent time for some people.
I think it felt, no, I didn't feel it as such. You know, somehow he had been preparing us for so long that it's not about the body, you know, like always the chair's empty, you know, like I'm just the finger pointing to the moon, you know, don't get stuck with a finger. And so we were, of course, you are in love with a person and you're in love with looking at him and listening to him and sitting there, you know, in front of you. But also we knew that we had to look inside to move on, you know, that the next step, the challenging step was now to look inside and not be focused on the outside. And so it was a beautiful time in India. We were there for another 1.5 years after that.
Miten, what were you doing there?
I was coordinating the meditation music. And the day that Osho left his body was one I'll never forget. It's a very amazing moment when you connect with your spiritual teacher. It's like destiny or something. It's hard to explain, but it's a love affair that's beyond the physical. You know, it's not like the way, say, that you would love your children or you would love your mother or your father or your beloved. It's physicality is not there. It's something you can't explain, and when the physical form is taken away, in this case when he left his body, there was an outpouring or an inpouring of light in my case, and it was just like a moment of bliss, you know. And Osho was always wanting us to learn to be who we really destined to be, and not to be put into some kind of path. Not to be, if you do this, this will happen. He was only concerned with pulling us out of any path that we might think we're on until we were actually alone, in our own aloneness, and to celebrate that. Because in our aloneness, we connect with compassion, we connect with the reality of we're all actually alone, but we're all together also, and then there can be a flowering of compassion and love.
How did you react then to his obvious self-indulgence around Rolls Royces and Rolex watches and all that stuff? I mean, wasn't there something in you that would have reacted and thought, gee, this doesn't look very spiritual to me?
Well, he wasn't spiritual in that way. You know, he would tell really blue jokes and he would do anything to destroy our concept of what a holy man is. So one of the things was, take me to America. I need some work. Let's go to America. So we find America. We find a big plot of land. And our plan is to create utopia, a meditation city where we can live together. And the first thing Osho does is confront American society. He loved to push the envelope, you know. So rather than do what would normally you would do, he would push something, you know. So it was so ridiculous. For me, it was just a huge joke.
The whole idea of utopia, a physical utopia.
The physical utopia was a great lesson because it was a lesson of impermanence. We worked 16 hours a day, and we worked and we loved every moment. It was called worship. It was our meditation. So it was like, whatever you do it as best you can, as best you can. And that was our way of creating this amazing place. And the next moment, wiped away, gone. And that in itself was an incredible teaching. Plus the fact that we were disgraced in front of the world, you know, that was also a very intense teaching for individuals. But A, I don't regret one moment of it, but B, it was incredible. Because that whole Rolls Royce thing, as far as I can see, the watches, was just, it was just like holding up a mirror to society and saying, look at the absurdity of what you believe is true and what you believe is worth working for, worth living for. Look how stupid this is, you know. So he was very controversial. I like that.
Deva Premal, how did you react to it? And do you know people who had been followers who were quite hurt by it?
Oh, yeah, many people.
I know more people who were really disappointed that the whole thing didn't work out and that it all evaporated. The Rolls Royces, somehow I felt most of us understood that it was really, like Miten said, a joke or a mirror, you know, a device. Also, you just felt that he didn't care about them. It wasn't like that he was attached to them or he was greedy for them or, you know, you could just feel it in him and the way he was that he didn't have an attachment to these things, you know.
Well, money seemed to be no object.
They were given to him and then they were sold afterwards, you know, when the whole thing.
I mean, just for the perspective, he spent 30 years in his room. He would come out to talk and come back. It was nothing. He wasn't like building up any kind of empire. You know, it might have looked like that. And probably the disciples around him may have had different concept. But him himself, he just let go one day and that was it. He was gone, you know.
Deva Premal, in the concert, you said when you were singing and getting the audience to sing with you that our main mission here is to disappear. Tell me about that, the philosophy behind your performance.
That's to sing these mantras, we disappear in the divine. And on one hand, we sing to the divine, you know, we praise God and we just express our bliss and gratitude and devotion. And on the other hand, we also invite the divine to come in us and dissolve us, you know, dissolve the ego, dissolve the separation, you know. And so in the concerts, that's what I feel like we dissolving the separation between there's the audience and there is us. And that's also with the clapping, you know, we don't clap, we sing together, you know, we're all in this together. So there's nobody needing to clap somebody else, you know. So, I mean, I feel that's what the spiritual path is about disappearing, you know, that the ego dissolves and you actually experience and live the oneness of everything.
You also hold ecstatic workshops, dance workshops, I think, up in Byron Bay?
Chant, singing.
Ecstatic chant.
Yeah.
What happens in that sort of scenario? Can you take me through what a ecstatic chant workshop looks like?
I mean, basically, you know, if I say it, it's basically singing, you know. But it's that experience of being together for a day with 80 to 100 people usually and going deeper into the mantras, taking them longer. Also, we just like also the musical side of things. So we like to put people in harmonies and then have different, you know, three voices singing together. So it actually sounds really like a beautiful choir. And dances, we do movements, we do Sufi dances, circle dances with the mantras, which is also a very beautiful way to bring the meditation into the body and the voice, you know.
One of the chants that really demonstrated the way you can bring an audience into harmony is the combination of there is so much magnificence near the ocean, waves are coming in. And on the other part of the audience is singing hallelujah. It is an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And their hands are in the air. It almost looks like a Pentecostal meeting, a Pentecostal church service where the hands are in the air and they're waving. Is that one of your specialties, one?
You know, gospel is an outgoing expression of God, and the mantras are more an ingoing expression of God. But it's basically the same thing, you're singing to God, you know. So, yeah, that particular piece is more rooted, I would say, in gospel.
But it's come out of the Osho.
It came from our ashram.
25 years ago. It started in Pune 25 years ago, this particular chant, and it's actually two lines out of a Kabir poem. There is so much magnificence near the ocean. It comes from a Kabir poem,
Kabir is a 13th century Sufi mystic.
Indian poet. Yeah.
In fact, your chantras go through different traditions, also Sikh mantras. Tell me about how you choose them, and how would you describe your own kind of spiritual tradition, quote unquote? Would you call yourself Hindu?
No, I'm an Osho disciple, which is beautiful because that's exactly the expression of what we sing, that we honor different paths through singing their sacred songs and chants. And with Osho also, he always talked about all the different paths. You know, he did a whole books on, or talks on Sufis, and talks on Jesus, and talks on Buddha and Zen, and everything with respect, and everyone is true, you know. Everyone comes from a different angle, and everyone highlights maybe a different aspect, but everyone is, you know, is the truth. And so I just use chants which I like, you know, simply, which where I like the translation, you know, where I like the sound of the words. Usually Sanskrit comes more easily for me, like it just, I can say it more easily, so I usually kind of gravitate towards Sanskrit.
Well, Sanskrit certainly has the ability to sort of caress the melodies, and you sing so beautifully. Were you trained classically to sing these chants?
No. I mean, I grew up with a Western classical background with music, with playing violin and piano, but I don't have any training.
Well, anyone listening to you would never imagine you were a blonde, blue-eyed, German-speaking young woman.
Om Purnamada Purnamida Purnat Purnam Udachate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnameva Vashishyate.
I wonder if you'd pick her for a European, the beautiful voice of Deva Pramal singing the Om Purnam mantra from her album Dakshina. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National with me, Rachel Kahn, and guests Deva Pramal and Miten, keeping the message and the music of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, or Osho, alive. You can find out more about my guests and the program by going to our website at abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things, where you can hear the program online for the next 4 weeks or download it onto your personal player. About some of the things you've done, because I understand that you have chanted for some pretty important people, one of whom is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the great mentor of dying gracefully.
We met Elizabeth in Sedona, actually in Phoenix, Arizona, where she lived before she left her body. And the first time we met her, she's very, I would say she was quite a sharp, gruff old lady, but very, she wouldn't suffer fools, and she liked the television. So we were taken into a room, the television was on, she was probably smoking at the time. She didn't really want to talk to us, but we were there, but she kept the television on, and after a while we bought the guitar, so I just thought, oh, you know what, I'm just going to get the guitar out and see what happens, because, you know, and just sit here. So we got the guitar out and we started singing, and then we started singing a Hopi chant called Shima, and before long she stopped smoking and turned the television off. And she began to join us, and I think she was in tears. I'm not sure if I can remember that rightly, but she was so touched, and she made us promise to sing at her funeral, and then she came every time we visited her. She always had Swiss chocolate. She loved Swiss chocolate, and all her friends and people would send us. So we were always meant to eat lots of Swiss chocolate while we were there, and we became friends. We didn't actually sing at our funeral because we were somewhere else, and it was once the family took over, it was a different thing. But we did sing for her many times, and we sang for her in our hearts even after she left.
What drew you to her bedside in the first place?
A friend just told us, "I've been visiting Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Would you like to meet her?" We're like, "Yes," and
also I always feel drawn to death and dying. I don't know. I find it very mysterious, and I find it very a big honor to be able to. It's happened a few times to us that we could sing for somebody on their deathbed, and it's always such a precious and real moment, you know, where there's no frills, you know, it's just straight to the point. And so I've been attracted to her in that way. Actually, only after I met her, I read her autobiography, which is incredible. I mean, she's just such a... But I often feel like that I would like to do more of that, to sing for dying people and to...
Well, we're all dying.
We're all dying.
It's true, it's happening.
It's happening anyway.
Indeed, but... I understand you also have sung for the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, that was very beautiful.
That was in Munich, and it was a conference for scientists and Buddhism, and how the science and Buddhism, you know, how they reflect each other, actually come to the same thing. And it was at the pre-conference where all the scientists were introducing themselves to His Holiness and sharing their experiences. And we were there too, and were invited to sing for him then with about 20 people in the room. And we knew that he loved the Tara mantra, and that actually a few weeks earlier he had been sick, and there was a message going around, please sing this mantra for him. This is his favorite mantra. So we sang this for him, which was very, you know, a very strong moment to also... In one hand, and also on the other hand, you know, he makes you feel so comfortable and so loved and accepted, but still it was like, wow. So that was a very special highlight.
And since then, we've heard that we just recently, actually, we met an Australian Lama on the Gold Coast he's about 78 years old, spent the last 30 or 40 years in Dharamsala with the Dalai Lama, close, almost friendship with him. And he told us that His Holiness actually loves to play our music for his own personal listening, which is really sweet.
Indeed. Is it possible for you to sing a little of the Tara mantra?
Yeah. So this is Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Svaha. And this is for the green Tara. The green Tara is the mother, the goddess of compassion. And just like a mother, as soon as you call her, she's there. She's ready to, you know, jump up any moment, just like a mother comes when the child calls. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha, Om Tare, Tu Tare, Tu Re, Svaha, Om Tare, Tu Tare, Tu Re. Svaha, Om Tare, Tu Tare, Tu Re.
You do manage to get the soul to float off somewhere else, certainly. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the compassion of the Tara is, it's all these deities, they're all reflections of our own self, you know. So it's just a way of awakening compassion in ourselves and acknowledging the compassion in ourselves, Tara. It's not about some fictional goddess in the Himalayas, you know.
Tell me about conveying this message to someone like your son, Miten, who's, what, in his 30s? Mm-hmm. And I gather he loves football. So does he relate to this, or are you in your orange clothes just a remnant from the hippie generation?
He relates to love. Everybody relates to love. The rest of it is irrelevant. Our paths are different, but the love is the same.
Well, you know, the hippie generation was the love generation.
That's true, that's true.
And today it seems that love in that idealistic vision has, what, evaporated?
Become old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, love, it doesn't come cheap, but it's there. It's there in everybody, I think. It's there in everybody. It's not just not easy to live it because we're bombarded with keeping ourselves alive and the struggle and the push and shove just to survive. But if you connect in the heart, it's there with every individual. As a movement is one thing. There's a wave. You can feel a wave of light right now in the world. That's the way I see it. That's a contrast to the darkness that is also obviously there. Individually, we're all struggling and sharing. But you know, I'm talking about us people, like the people who probably listen to your show and you. We are a family now. We're a big family, and it's not just confined to one country. Wherever Deva and I sing, we see the same people, you know, in different bodies. And so we are riding a wave of love individually. But, of course, individually, we've got all our own personal issues and, you know, relating, how we relate to the people we work with, how we relate to the people we love and connect with. It's always a challenge to love.
It must also be a challenge, too, being a follower of Osho, because what did happen in Oregon was pretty serious. I mean, some people had committed serious crimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of, you know, those experiments in the 80s, in the 70s, had serious casualties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So a younger generation looks back and says, well, where was that at? You know, where was the love when people were trying to poison other people in Oregon?
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean that's all part of the cosmic play, I think. You know, I don't defend any of it, but I just look around at the people that were there and the people that I know now in their late 50s and 60s. I find them very beautiful people, you know, who've been through something very extreme.
How many of there are you? How many people still wear the orange clothes?
Oh, nobody. Nobody. I only wore this just to really impress you.
Well, you both have orange.
It just happened. I said to Miten, Rachel's going to think we always look, we're always in partner look. It just happened. We, you know, Osho left the whole red clothes thing in 85.
So yes, since that's 85, right. He wore black, actually.
No, I mean, all of us dropped the red clothes in 85.
Uh-huh.
And I personally warm two more years because I just loved it, you know. I just felt so good in it. But so we haven't, that's been gone. It's just a
remnant. Well, how many people would say they are still followers of Osho?
I think if you asked all the people who passed through those ashram gates to put red clothes on one day, you'd probably be amazed. But it's not that we play for, you know, disciples of Rajneesh anymore, like you saw at the concert. There was, I don't know, 800 people, and we just, it's like that everywhere we go. I think what Rajneesh gave us, the most important thing is the music. And, you know, this music was born in that ashram. It didn't come from... Deva never wanted to be a nightclub singer. She's never sung in a nightclub, you know, or a rock club or festival. She's only sang in meditations halls. And for me, it was somehow similar. I stopped playing music when I came to the ashram because it just hurt me so much. I was carrying so much. So the first thing I did when I realized that moon I was talking about was to pick up all my guitars and sell every one so that I could afford to contribute. And that was my life. And for a few years, I was happy to, you know, be in the kitchen and be part of the commune and cleaning the whatever, doing it with total 100% authentic awareness, you know. And through that, my music came back, and it came back in a very, very simplified form, because all I wanted to do was to say thank you. And in that, this music came from a very unselfconscious space.
Well, you still have an impish presence on stage, a wonderful sort of comedic contrast to sageful, wise.
Well, Deva, I tell you, Deva cracks me up quite often.
Deva, let's end with the Mula Mantra. That has quite an important significance.
The Mula Mantra is a beautiful mantra because it honors Mula is root in Sanskrit, and it honors the divine creator, so that's the divine in its unmanifest form. It honors the divine as our spiritual teachers, gurus, avatars. It honors the divine that's in every living being, in all of us. And then I always see it like the yin and the yang. The end of the mantra is Sri Bhagavati, the female principle, Samhita, in communion with Sri Bhagavati, the male principle. So I kind of always see that yin and yang at the end of the mantra there. And we sing it now? Okay, please. Om Satchidananda Parabrahma Purushottama Paramatma Shri Bhagavati Samhita, Shri Bhagavate Nama, Om Satchidananda Parabrahma Purushottama Paramatma Shri Bhagavati Samhita Shri Bhagavate Nama Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Beautiful. It's hard to say anything after that, except to thank you both so very much for coming and speaking to me today.
Thank you, Rachel. It's been very nice to meet you.
Namaste.
Namaste. The traditional Sanskrit greeting, which means, I bow to you. When I saw Deva Pramal and Miten perform in Sydney a few days before our interview, I was impressed by the beauty of the performance and the faultless ease with which Deva Pramal chanted. So I was surprised when at the end of our interview, Miten made a confession.
See, if I was Deva's music teacher, I would be like, uncross your legs, and open your diaphragm. This is how ongoing. Deva doesn't regard herself as a singer. Can you believe that? And I used to say to her, you know what, you've been given a gift. You need to honor that gift. You need to open your voice before concerts. You need to, you know, open your voice, you know, like do some exercises and sort of thing. She would, I just couldn't get her to do it. And then she would walk out on stage and just sing like this, you know, so I shut up. Now I never say that anymore.
Divine guidance. Well, don't you have a special connection to the Gayatri Mantra?
Mm.
Tell me about it.
Very special. Because it's the first thing I heard, you know, even before I was born, I was listening to it from my father, singing it to my mother. And then as I was being born, he was singing it for her. And then as a child, I sang it every night as a good night song. Like, we sang it 3 times every night. And my sister and I, we sang it together. And then I enjoyed the singing part of it, I remember. I didn't really know what I was singing. And as soon as I could not do it anymore because they didn't watch me doing it, I dropped it pretty much. And then I had a phase where I wanted to become Christian and get baptized and everything. So I sang the Gayatri Mantra kind of officially out loud and then secretly the Lord's Prayer, because I thought maybe they weren't my, I thought maybe my parents wouldn't like it, but actually they were really, when I said, you know, I want to become Christian, they were like, okay, you know, it's your choice, it's your life, you're totally welcome. So then I left the whole, all the mantras behind me, you know, also because in Osho's ashram, we didn't focus so much on mantras because he was so untraditional. And then I got together with Miten when I was 20 and actually just wanted to find a way to be with him all the time, and that singing was the best way to do that. Literally, I mean, I was like, okay, like, what can I do here? And for 7 years we were just traveling around. I was his girlfriend. He was the famous one because in the ashram everyone knew him. He'd been playing for everyone, for 2,000-3,000 people every night. So he was like, you know, we could call up the centers around the world and say, yeah, this is Miten, and can we come and play for you? And yeah, they, you know, they would know him. And I was the little girlfriend, you know, the shadow and the support, and I like to sing harmonies and second voice. It comes very naturally. And but I also felt, if this is this relationship, for this relationship and for myself, I need to find a new step, otherwise this is not going to be healthy. I can't support him forever, you know. I was so shy, even in soundcheck I wouldn't make one sound alone, you know. I was totally in awe. And then when I was 27, I heard the Gayatri Mantra again and started singing it, and I realized, wow, when I sing this, I'm not shy. My voice sounds good, you know, it sounds strong. I can carry it. And I realized that's really... there's an Osho quote where he says the mantras are like seeds and they get planted in you, and then when the time is ripe, then the tree blossoms and all these flowers appear. And that's really how it happened for me, that the Gayatri Mantra was put into me so early on, and it just needed a long, like almost 20 years or not quite, yeah, 15 years before it really became in full bloom. And then more and more mantras came. And then we thought, okay, let's make a CD for our friends, you know. Very cheap. We just do it in my mother's place. That's the place where I was born, where I was being sung to. So we did this CD, which was called The Essence, or which is called The Essence. And we thought we'll just press 1,000 copies for our friends for massage. And we thought we'd make the pieces quite long so people can use them for, you know, meditation. And now it's 215,000 copies later. I mean, it's just, and it's still selling like the first day. And it's somehow that magic really kind of got captured on that CD, you know, like the magic of the Gayatri Mantra.
Well, we had Deva in one room and our mixing desk in the other room. We ran a line and a microphone into the room next door to where she was born with our father singing the mantra. And then we were in the other room. Deva sang the Gayatri Mantra. She must have been in there I would guess anywhere between half an hour and an hour, just singing continually. And when she came out, she said, she doesn't usually say things like this, but she said, the room feels like it's charged with energy. And we heard this voice coming through and we were like, wow, you know, because we were all unprepared for it, I must say, you know. Even me, and I'd heard her sing for the last 7 or 8 years, so I could, you know, encourage her to do this. But when she got in front of the right microphone with the right ambiance, it was right, and that energy must have gone onto the plastic somehow, you know.
And then somehow the circle with my father closed when he was 2 years ago, that he was about to leave his body. He was 83 years old and he was in hospital, and we were on tour, and my parents called me, or my sister and my mother called me, you know, he might leave his body any moment, come, you know, if we can. So we could come, which was already a very blessed thing that we were in another continent.
It was kind of a midnight race, race in the car to get back in time.
And we sat there with him in the intensive ward. He was not conscious anymore, and sat there for a while, I sang the Gayatri, I sang different mantras I knew which were good for leaving the body and making a transition. And then hours went by and he didn't leave his body, so then you kind of, or at least I, you know, then you kind of, who knows how long this is going to take, you know. And you kind of, also I couldn't be in there all the time because we had to share the space, we couldn't all be in the room. But it really just happened that half an hour before he left his body, we started singing the Gayatri again, and we sang it to the end of his life. Mm. So it was like until his last breath. So the way he sang it to me, coming into the world, I sang it to him leaving the world. And that was also the first time that I could be there with somebody leaving their body. And it was a huge gift he gave me, and I hope I could give him too.
Svā tatsavitu vareniyam bhargo devasya dhimahi iyo yona prachodayat.
What a rare privilege. And in the Indian tradition of reincarnation, you could say that Deva Pramal was presiding over her father's rebirth. You can find out about Deva Pramal and Miten's music on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And while you're there, you can download the audio or read a transcript. The music you're hearing now is the Gayatri Mantra. The program was produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound production today by Mark Dawn. Next week, it's another highlight from the year as we examine the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, founder of the Unification Church, known as the Moonies, and his influence within the U.S. government. That's Moon, Money, and Messiah, next time here on ABC Radio National Summer, with me, Rachel Kahn.
Om Bhuvasva Tat Savitru Vareniyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.